This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and this is the Woman's Hour podcast from Tuesday, the 16th of April, 2019. Today on the podcast, you'll hear about the birth control activist and sex counsellor in the 1950s, Joan Mallison. We'll talk to two women who are using their skills to solve some environmental problems, recyclable coffee cups and a sustainable leather substitute made from pineapple leaves. How about that? We'll talk about food allergies in children as well. Is there a so-called right age to have children, as the latest ONS statistics reveal that for the first time in England and Wales, more babies are born to women in their 30s than women in their 20s. And the number of women who've got pregnant in their 40s has doubled in the last two decades. So is there a best age to have a child? Your thoughts on Twitter are sort of throughout the programme, really. And then there's some emails on this subject at the end of the podcast. First, though, to Sudan, where the 30-year rule of the leader Omar al-Bashir came to an end last week. Now, he's been replaced by a military council, which is promising a two-year transition period and then elections. But not everyone's overwhelmed. The protests on the streets have continued and women are still very prominent. You might recall images of a 22-year-old, Ala Salah, going viral last week. And this is pretty extraordinary in a country where women have very few rights. I talked today to Rosalind Marsden, who was the British ambassador to Sudan between 2007 and 2010. She's now a fellow of Chatham House, the independent foreign policy institute. And we also heard from Nima El-Bajir, who is Sudanese and a correspondent for CNN. She was in the capital, Khartoum.
We were at the demonstration site till about 3 in the morning, and the numbers are still pretty significant. No doubt today they'll be boosted by the fact that the country's new military rulers, I should say the country's latest military rulers, have been given 2 weeks by the African Union to arrange for a civilian transition to power, which is the key demand here.
And what about the role of women out on the streets? Are they still out there?
Absolutely. That's what's been really extraordinary to see. It's not just that women played such an amazing role. They managed to subvert what is an extraordinarily conservative cultural attitude towards women, which on some levels works for women, because it meant that even though, don't get me wrong, a lot of women were beaten, a lot of women were abused, tortured and threatened with rape by the National Intelligence Services, by the organs of the state, it is still in this country very difficult to comprehend seeing women being publicly abused, being hit in the streets. Even the worst of the worst have found that somehow to be this kind of difficult thing to overcome, even within their own psyches. And these young women used that to their credit and to their benefit and stood up in a way that's almost being mythologized. You can hear it in the poetry and the songs that are being sung about them at the demonstration sites. They led this demonstration, but they're still there. Again, this is a really conservative culture, so I can't understate what it means to be at the demo site at 2 in the morning and have young, unmarried women manning the barricades. It's really amazing.
We mustn't forget the name that has come very much to the fore. That's Ala Salah, who is the woman of 22, dressed in white robes, who I think she was on the roof of a car, wasn't she? And
yes.
Her image just went everywhere.
Yes, the image, I think, captured the world, but also captured people's imaginations here, because it mirrors a lot of the iconography of the Nubian queens, the Gandakes, that have been used again and again to describe these women, so the beautiful moon gold earrings, the white dog, which was used by the women's movement here in the 60s, when women first pushed for full voting rights. And Sudan was the first country in the Arab League to give women full voting rights. So it gives you a sense of how far back they have been forced by the former regime, by the Islamist movement. So it harkened back to that, even for the older generation of women here, to see this woman dressed in the white robes of the women's movement in the 60s, wearing the gold earrings and looking essentially like a Nubian queen. But when you see these women in the streets, that's what they're being called. They're being called the Gandakes, the pharaonic Nubian queens. But, and it's harkening back to this kind of matrilineal mythology of the pharaohs here in Sudan. I mean, I'm 40, so this is not my generation. But even for me, it's beautiful to see.
Rosalind, this is evocative stuff, isn't it? So what do you think about what you've heard from Nima there?
It is absolutely extraordinary, the scale of female participation in these protests, which was absolutely unprecedented. Sudanese women have become now very aware of their power and their role as agents of change, and they feel very much empowered. And of course, the emergence of women and also young people as a new powerful social and political force on the streets, you know, this has really changed the whole political landscape. It's also been part of a wider social revolution during the last 4 months of protests. So, you know, whatever happens now, nothing's ever going to go back to how it was before.
Well, take us back to your time as ambassador to Sudan. This is between the years 2007 and 2010. And you used to have quite regular meetings, didn't you, with groups of women?
Yes, I did. I discovered initially when I arrived in Khartoum as ambassador that many of my meetings in the ministries and with politicians and with officials were largely with men. So I made a conscious decision to set up a sort of women's forum. So every few weeks I had a meeting in the residence with women from all sorts of political parties to discuss the issues that were of concern to them. And they included women from the ruling National Congress Party as well as all the opposition parties. And what struck me was that one of the issues of most concern to all of them was the arbitrary application of Sudan's very repressive public order law, which enables the so-called public order police, who are kind of morality police, to go around harassing women, for example, for the clothes they're wearing. If they're wearing trousers, they're liable to be detained and even lashed and fined.
Which makes what Nima says all the more impressive, the fact that, as she said, young, unmarried women are out on the streets of Khartoum at 2 a.m. Just about unthinkable, presumably.
It is just about unthinkable. And I think women's rights in Sudan have deteriorated significantly during the 30 years of Bashir's regime. The regime manipulated its religion to undermine women's position and to exclude women in particular from the public space. So for many years, women have fought against this kind of oppression, and this is one of the reasons why they must have come out in the streets in such large numbers.
We've got to be realistic about this. Is it fair to say that Britain was doing business with Bashir?
I think it's fair to say that everyone was doing business with al-Bashir. The European Union invested heavily in al-Bashir's promise to block illegal migration. The United States continued normalization talks until literally the day he was deposed. Everybody did business with al-Bashir. And even now, number two in the Military Transitional Council is somebody whose forces are essentially a reimagined Janjaweed militia, the Rapid Support Forces. As you said, we do have to be realistic. But at the same time, I think it's really important to point out that everything about this movement has been a rebuke to everything, not just the international community's stances, but also the conservative attitudes that have been given new life under the Islamist regime, whether that's the conscious use of music publicly, which was banned in the early years of the regime, whether that's the use of poetry, or the very, very clear leadership role of women.
Based, Nima, on what you've seen and heard, are you fearful or genuinely optimistic?
I'm incredibly optimistic, I would say, because the fact that they did not step down immediately, the fact that they knew enough to know that this was not good enough, that al-Bashir stepping down was not good enough, that even Awadim Nirov, the military ruler who succeeded him as the head of the Transitional Military Council, was not good enough. And nothing short of a clear timetable transition to civilian rule would be enough. But of course, you know, there are so many steps between now and actually solidifying a democratic transition. So we are going to have to wait and see. But spending time with these kids, perhaps I'm a little bit revolution drunk or whatever you call it, but they are very clear about what needs to happen and hopefully they will be able to achieve it.
And Rosalind mentioned the effectively the morality police. Are they anywhere to be seen?
It's very confusing because the Transitional Council has said that any laws that in any way repress personal freedoms have been suspended. But then they separately released a statement saying, and we are looking into the Public Order Act, which is what the morality police derive their power from. So you can see all of us kind of slightly teetering. I did a couple of live broadcasts from the street, not really knowing, should my headscarf be up? Should it be down? A few brave souls have had their headscarves down. They have, in some ways, gotten into the soul of us. It will probably take a little while for people to make their own personal choices about whether they are or are not going to cover their heads, which, of course, is as it should be, because there's no clear delineation whether it's legal or not. But even just the very fact that women are out in the numbers that they're out at night singing, dancing publicly shows that they are, their grip is already beginning to loosen.
Rosalind, what do you think is going to happen over the next couple of days and weeks?
Well, I think the situation right now is clearly at a very critical and delicate stage, potentially dangerous stage even. They're up against a transitional military council, which is still composed of senior military officers who served under the Bashir regime.
And they're all men, presumably.
They're certainly all men in the military council, and they are part of what's been called a deep state, a patronage network built up over 30 years by Bashir. That's not going to be easy to dislodge and dismantle in the short term. And of course, the opposition and the protest movement are very keen that that is indeed what needs to happen. I think whether everything moves forward in a positive direction will also depend to some extent on whether the international community continues to keep up the pressure. And as Nima described, for the last few years, the Western governments have been trying to improve relations with previous regime, but they have now come out very clearly saying there has to be a swift and credible transition to civilian rule. And I think the African Union statement of yesterday, giving the Transitional Military Council 15 days to transition, is very important. So, you know, there's going to be a big struggle still to come, but I think there are some reasons for cautious optimism.
Rosalind Marsden, British ambassador to Sudan between 2007 and 2010. And you also heard from Nima al-Bashir, who is a CNN correspondent. Nima is herself Sudanese. And as she said, she was at those latest protests overnight in the capital, Khartoum. Some quite incredible scenes she was describing there. Now, to your thoughts on having babies at various ages. Carly Emma on Twitter: I just had my fourth child at 36, having had my first at 20. It's hard work no matter what age, but I definitely had more energy and physical resilience at 20. As a maternity historian, I think the modern obsession with maternal age is unhealthy and it smacks of patriarchal control. Interesting. Thank you, Carly Emma. And from a listener called Helen: I had my daughter at 33. Sorry, I'm just going to move the mouse there. God, I'm multi-skilling here. Helen says, I had my daughter at 33, probably too late to enjoy the fourth and fifth generations to come, and not late enough to reduce population increase, but the right time for my body and life, and before 34, the age my mum died, and when I would run out of maternal route map. Now, that's something I'd never thought of, but clearly it was a factor for Helen. And we welcome your thoughts on this at BBC Women's Hour on social media. Now, you probably know that there are protests, climate change activists out on the streets of London. They are out there today. They were there yesterday as well and overnight. Thousands have joined in. Oxford Street's blocked, Marble Arch, Piccadilly Circus, roads around Parliament Square are closed off. It is World Earth Day next week on the 22nd of April. And we have already had a series of conversations about climate change and the environment and what you can do on Women's Hour. And on Good Friday, this Friday, we've got tips really on what you can do in the home to do your bit in the name of climate change and the environment. But I thought you'd be interested in this. Two women who have used their ingenuity to come up with possible solutions for environmental problems. Dr. Fania Ismail is one of our guests. She's invented a waterproof material that will be used in disposable coffee cups. And Dr. Carmen Ehoza has come up with a natural textile made from pineapple leaf fibre, which could be used as a leather substitute. Fania, good morning, first of all. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much. How are you?
Well, it's really interesting to talk to you. Very well, thank you. This material you've invented for coffee cups, I've got a disposable coffee cup in front of me now, to my shame. What difference is your invention going to make?
The one you've got in front of you is consists of two layers. The outer layer is paper, but inside you've got a plastic layer. And they're hot pressed against each other, so water doesn't leak from your cup.
Right.
And that plastic has a problem because you can't get rid of them. And as we speak now, every single minute in the UK alone, 5,000 of these cups makes their way into the landfill and only 1% gets recycled. That's about 2.5 billion cups a year in the UK alone. And rough figures are saying there is a minimum of 250 billion a year globally.
So this is a massive problem. Your material is called Solgel. What is it?
Well, the Solgel process is well known. Scientists in academia and industry worldwide use it for different purposes. The difference we have made to the process is we have added additional materials on a molecular level, which makes the end product unique. So what this product does is, once applied to paper and cardboard, it makes it completely water impermeable. So therefore, you don't need any plastic layer anymore.
Now, one of the chief ingredients, I think, is glass. Is that right?
It's a glass-like material. Solgel is a process where you make glass-like material at room temperature. So the raw materials extracted from sand, and silica is a major component of sand. So the silica part is the raw materials that you can make Solgel-based products from.
And is the process of manufacturing it, is that environmentally friendly?
Yes, it is. Solgel, if you speak to anybody in any industry, you will find that that's their favourable technology. If it works for them, they will all go for Solgel as a coating, because it's, you can do different things from it. And also the process, doesn't require capital investment, so you don't need a lot of energy consumption. It is really the best technology out there that you can use in terms of being less toxic.
In that case, how close are you to supplying the leading manufacturers of these coffee cups?
We are currently working with leading industry partners. So we have at least, three key partners that we are working with, and they are entering into a joint partnership with us, joint development partnership, so we can apply it on industrial scale. So kind of we finished all the initial testing and we are entering into the industrial scale testing. And once this is done, then we are predicting our product to be out there within the next 6 to 18 months. I mean, roughly speaking, another 3 months, we will have our first range of products.
Thank you very much. So, Carmen, yours is this natural textile. It sounds fascinating. Pineapple leaf fibre, which you get hold of from where?
Good morning, everyone. Pinatex is indeed, as you say, a natural material made from pineapple leaf fibre. And these fibres come today from the Philippines, where I was working, started work in the 90s, and discovered that the whole range of natural fibres.
OK, comes from the Philippines. It has to be shipped over, what, to Europe?
No, it's processed in the Philippines. We work from the farming communities up to the first stage of the material. The material goes from farming communities, where they take the waste leaves, They extract the fibres, wash dry, then it goes to a factory where it's degummed, which means we take all the gum out of these fibres, also in the Philippines, and then it goes into a non-woven process, also in the Philippines. So it leaves the Philippines as a non-woven textile material already. So half of the added value remains in the Philippines. And there are no places in the Philippines today to fully develop piñatex. So what we do is we ship it and we bring it to Spain, where we've got two partner companies, where they do finishings.
Okay, I mean, it's interesting. It's important, isn't it, that some of the success of this product is shared with the Philippines, which is a developing country.
Totally, and that was the reason, and it is the reason where we will always work like that. Obviously, we don't have pineapples in England or in Europe, so it makes a lot of sense as well. But the reality is that that is really a very important part of what piñatex is.
And
it helps farming communities.
And it's a replacement for pleather or leather or both?
Both, in fact. Leather replaces leather, and that was my idea because I worked with leather before inventing this new material. And pleather, which is basically plastic leather, so it can replace any plastic petroleum-based textiles as well.
Lots of people, of course, feel very strongly about leather and would therefore go for pleather. But it's just one of the many illustrations of how complicated this world is. The manufacture of pleather is not very environmentally friendly, is it?
Absolutely not. I mean, pleather is basically plastic material, which is polyurethane or PVC. PVC is the most damaging plastic in the planet, really. So it is not really very sustainable. It takes forever to...
carry on, Carmen, go on.
To disintegrate, if ever it does disintegrate, it's really not something that we would like to use. It's not very good for the skin, it's not breathable, etc.
The fact is, though, that cows exist. So what do you think about leather?
Leather is a different story, you know. I was working with leather for many years. As you say, exactly, cows exist. And leather is a byproduct of the meat industry. So the reality is that we've got too many cows in the world, 1.5 billion cattle in the world, causing a huge amount of damage, environmental damage. And the reality is that we have to see what can we do not to have so many animals, which is simply, please stop eating so much meat, and then we will not have this problem.
Are you someone, Carmen, who lies awake at night worrying about all this? And I'm very aware that I'm speaking at the moment only 500 metres or so away from the climate change protesters. And whatever you think about the disruption they're causing, many people feel very passionately about these issues, don't they?
Well, of course, I think we really need to. I don't stay awake at night because I'm happy with what I'm doing. I passionately believe in what I'm doing is good for the earth and good for people. So I don't have that worry, maybe a bit tired, but that's another story. And I think these people that are just basically there in Waterloo Bridge, where we are in Somerset House, they're trying to do something that the government or anybody seems to really find a solution to, and they're doing their best. And I totally sympathize with them.
Thank you very much. Fania, do you feel the same way?
Yes, I mean, it's I kind of see it as a responsibility of everyone to step up and, do good for our environment, for the society. So it's kind of people are becoming much, much more aware of it. And, it's a similar position, really.
Thank you very much. That's Fania Ishmael. You also heard from Carmen Ihoza. And on Good Friday, as I say, there'll be more on what you can do, what we can all do in our everyday lives to make this situation slightly better. Lucy Siegel is one of my guests on Good Friday morning on the programme. Now, next week, how mental health can impact on a relationship. If you have depression or anxiety, how much can you, how much should you expect from a partner? What if your partner is the one with the mental health issue? What is the right way? What is the best way to try to support them? We'd love your experiences. You can email us, of course, via the website or contact us on social media at BBC Woman's Hour. We do welcome your experiences there. I suspect many people listening will have something to say on that topic. It's really, really interesting and important. Now, to someone I bet you've never heard of, I certainly had never heard of her, but this is a fascinating little chunk of a life experience. The name Dr. Joan Malleson might not mean a great deal, but she was big news in the 30s, 40s and 50s. She was a birth control activist, a family planning doctor, and she wrote a book called Any Wife or Any Husband, described as for couples who've met sexual difficulties and for doctors. She wasn't trained as one, but she did work as a therapist. And a historian, Dr. Carolyn Rustelholtz, has come across some recordings of her sexual counselling sessions in the archives of the Wellcome Library. Carolyn, good morning to you.
Good morning.
We should say, of course, that the people she was counselling did not know these recordings had been made, which these days sets your nerve endings jangling a bit, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. But at that time, we had different ethical guidelines. And basically, Malleson, I think, wanted to preserve the spontaneity of the patient's narrative. And also she withdrew any personal information and she edited these tapes.
Right. Who was she? For people who've never heard of her.
Joan Malleson. She was a birth control activist, a family planning doctor, committed family planning doctor. One of the first women doctors to provide contraceptive advice to married women in family planning clinics. She was also very committed to make abortion legal. She was part of the Law Reform Association for Abortion. And she was also one of the first sexual therapists in the 40s and 50s in London.
So what do you think, listening to the recordings, what's your overriding impression?
She tried to be as helpful as she could towards her patient. And basically the heterosexual married women who came to her were presenting some form of sexual difficulties and they wanted to have an enjoyable sexual life. And Malleson provided practical advice, but also she did a talkative cure to try to find the reasons behind sexual difficulties.
Now, I imagine that back then, actually, let's be honest, now, most women would find talking about these issues really difficult. So who were the women that felt able to talk to her?
Well, some of the women were referred by their own psychologists and other doctors. And otherwise, there were women that came to the family planning center because Malleson realized when she was providing contraceptive advice to married women that their difficulties were not limited to contraception, but expanded to marital difficulties. So she would ask whether she enjoyed sexual life, for instance. So these women were coming from the middle class, I would say. Some of them might have come from the working class because Malleson might have recorded those sessions in three different locations in London, at the North Kensington Women Welfare Centre, which was a family planning clinic, at her private practice, and at the University College Hospital, where she was head of a contraceptive clinic.
Did she speak to any men? Were there any men at these sessions?
Yes, three husbands came along, which show how actually husbands started to feel that having a pleased wife in terms of sexuality was very important for their sexual life.
Yeah, and what's the dynamic like in the conversations where men are there? Can you tell the difference?
Well, she did an interview the couple together, so she had private session with the men, but she was still in charge. Malleson was in charge of the session. She would ask questions and then let the patient answer, but she would also provide her own interpretation of the feeling of the patient, which today might seem a bit weird.
Yeah, well, it would, but I suppose we can't look at it too much through our 21st century lens,
yeah.
Can we? But the advice she was giving, how much of that would be all right today or acceptable?
I think she still have... I mean, she was encouraging women to have sexual pleasure through the clitoris when those women couldn't achieve vaginal orgasm. Because basically, the main reason for these women to consult Malleson was were either a vaginismus, which is the contraction of...
Just define that for anybody who's not certain.
So it is the contraction of the muscles at the entrance of the vagina.
Which makes penetration
difficult or
sex
painful.
Impossible. Yeah, okay. Oh, just painful. Or exactly. Just painful. I don't mean that, but yeah, carry on.
Otherwise, it was inhibition of orgasm. So women having the ability to enjoy sex, but who couldn't achieve orgasm. Or frigidity, which is a lack of sensations and lack of sexual feelings. And Malaison provided advice and pushed the patient to reflect on their traumatic events that happened during their childhood. And I think that's still something that is going on today. And she also tried to reassure them towards the pressure they felt to have a performative and enjoyable sex life by telling them that everyone is different and clitoral orgasm is as valuable than a vaginal orgasm.
Yeah. She wasn't quite the first person to put a person's attitude to sex into the context of the rest of their life. But I don't know how many other people around that time would be having such direct conversations with women in particular. What do you think?
Yes. It could be quite hard to tell, but she was definitely part of a broader movement which aimed at helping couples overcome their sexual difficulties. And this movement started from the 1920s with Mary Stopes' very famous manual, Married Wife. And then other sexual reformists were publishing sexual manuals and medical manuals. But she was one of the first to provide practical exercising and practical advice to married women. And I underline the fact that most of the women were married because at that time, family planning association were targeting married women.
And of course, this is all pre the Abortion Act of 1967.
Exactly.
So there was
The Family Planning Act.
Yes, and the Family Planning Act. So women were pretty vulnerable, actually, weren't they, in many, many cases?
Yes, exactly. But there was this new discourse coming from the interwar years that tried to encourage female sexual pleasure. So at the same time, this new discourse could have been liberating for women because they could claim a form of sexual rights to pleasure. But at the same time, it increased anxieties because couples felt compelled to have a beautiful and enjoyable sexual life. And when they couldn't, they experienced anxiety.
And today, how much has changed?
I think we still are in the society where having a performative and very enjoyable sexual life.
Pornography plays a part in that, doesn't it?
Of course. Yeah.
What would Joan have made of that, do you think?
Well, I remember hearing her saying that that was a fallacy of her generation, this emphasis that everyone should have an orgasm. So she was very aware of the pressure that people felt around having an orgasm. So I think she might have been quite critical too.
Yes, it's interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Everything changes and nothing does, basically.
Yeah.
Dr. Carolyn Rusterholz, and actually you, I hope you don't mind me saying, you are about to have your first child, aren't you?
Yes, I do.
And I know we've discussed this, so I'm not being too intrusive. You are
33.
You weren't sure, but you're 34 on...
No, 33 on Thursday.
Oh, 33 on Thursday, okay. In the latter stages of pregnancy, it's quite easy to forget how old you are, so don't worry about that.
Thank you.
And I've got no excuse, and I can very rarely remember how old I am. Well, I hope that goes well for you. I only ask because we are discussing or making reference on this morning's programme to the fact that the ONS figures are now suggesting it is more common in England and Wales to have a baby in your 30s than in your 20s. And you've been telling us your thoughts on this. Jan says, I had my first baby at 39, second at 41, after being told I could never have children. Hard work no matter what age you have your babies, but indescribable joy, she says. We've got others on this subject. Colette, I'm 34, currently expecting my first child. I'm also one of the first among my female friends to have a child. I agree that focus on the so-called right age is a patriarchal obsession. Surely more important for the mother to be physically and mentally healthy. Age no longer dictates this. Samantha, I've just had my first at 31. I am far more rational, empathetic and calm than I would have been in my 20s. I've got the emotional intelligence to take a breath before reacting or panicking. My career's in great shape for me to return to. I'm glad we waited, says Samantha. Congratulations to you and thank you very much, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Now, food allergies, here's another one that Carolyn's now obliged to pay attention to, in children. It affects up to 6% of children in the developed world. These allergies do appear to be on the rise. Last week, we talked about diagnosis and management of food allergies. This week, how to feed your child well if they have an allergy. Claire Thornton-Wood is a paediatric dietitian. Welcome to the programme, Claire. So where do we start with this? Most common food groups that children can be allergic to, what are they?
So the most common food group is milk. That's the most common one. And then following that, it's eggs. And then it becomes peanuts, tree nuts, fish, a bit less common, wheat.
Right. Let's start with milk, obviously. Can you be allergic to breast milk?
You can be allergic to breast milk, and the reason for that is because the foods that the mother eat then pass through the breast milk and are consumed by the baby. So yes, if we have a child that has an allergy to a particular food, we would ask the mother to remove that food from her diet.
Right, okay, but not easy to do, to put it mildly.
It depends what it is, but no, possibly not easy to do.
How would you know, actually, if a very young baby was allergic to breast milk?
I mean, you would be looking at the kind of symptoms that they would have. I think it's probably first of all important to say there are two types of allergy. There's what we call an IgE allergy. So that is the allergy most people would think of, the anaphylaxis, the potential swelling of the lips, hives all over the body. That's very sudden and happens within often within minutes, but certainly within a couple of hours of eating a particular food. The other type of allergy is called a non-IgE allergy, and that's a kind of slow-burning allergy that sometimes can take days, even weeks, to appear and tends to manifest itself in things more like chronic eczema, constipation, faltering growth, abdominal pain, that kind of thing. So clearly, if you have the more immediate type of reaction, it's often quite easy to pinpoint what has caused it. So you can then quite easily
remove. But the other type is actually no less difficult, is it?
The other type is more difficult. So with an IgE allergy, you can have tests for that. You can have a skin prick test. You can have IgE blood tests, and that can give you a very good answer. With the other type of allergy, it's more like a trial and error. So you have a look at, a healthcare professional would, usually a dietitian would have a look at the diet, think the mother may even have an idea of what it is, and then you would remove that food from the diet. And if the symptoms then improve, the gold standard is to put the food back into the diet. If the symptoms reappear, then you know you've hit on the right food.
If you have a family where there are a lot of people with even quite mild eczema, should you be concerned?
You should be concerned because there is something we know called the allergic march, where people who have eczema, I mean, I'm not talking about small patches, I'm talking about sort of quite bad eczema,
yeah,
are more likely to go on to develop other allergies like food allergies and asthma and hay fever. So it's really important if your child has got eczema to actually really get on top of that, because if you think about it, your skin is like a barrier. It's like you're sitting in a plastic bag, and your plastic bag is designed, it's waterproof really, and it's designed to keep everything out. If you've got eczema, you've actually got really quite large areas of very exposed skin, and then the allergens are actually able to penetrate through. And we know that that then predisposes people to become allergic to particular foods.
The milk ladder is something that I honestly had never heard of. What does that mean?
OK, so the milk ladder is something that's been developed over many, many years and refined, and is a way of bringing milk back into a child's diet when we think that they're growing out of their allergy. So it's really important to say that the milk ladder needs to be done under medical guidance, usually a dietitian, and it should not be used for any child that has an IgE immediate type reaction. So the milk ladder is where we use milk in very small amounts, going up to larger amounts, and we use milk that's very, very well cooked, like in a biscuit or a cupcake, going up to yogurt and then a glass of milk. And the idea behind it is it's the protein in the milk that causes the difficulty. The protein is a certain shape. once you heat it or treat it by making it slightly more acidic, the shape of it changes, and then the receptors in your body don't recognise it in just the same way. It's a bit like putting a Lego brick. If you've got them, they go really well together. If you were to put one of your Lego bricks in the microwave and change its shape, it then wouldn't fit together.
Got you. OK, that's a really good way of describing it. So to peanut butter or peanuts, which obviously is a big, big area, I've heard the idea that people purport to have done, that you give your child a peanut butter sandwich, but in the car park of a hospital with an A&E, and then see what happens. Is that a good idea?
I do know that mothers do that.
Every A&E in the country is going to be going bonkers now.
Cause a traffic jam in the car parks. It used to be said that you shouldn't give your children highly allergenic foods at a young age. Certainly when I had my children, it was the mother didn't eat peanuts, the children didn't have peanuts when they were babies. That advice has now changed, and we are saying that children should be given. There's the EAT study and the LEAP study have shown that we should now be giving children foods that are potentially allergenic at a much younger age. So around 6 months, when you're weaning them, you should start to offer them things like peanuts. Obviously, you mustn't give them whole peanuts, so you use peanut powder, which you can then mix into things like yogurt or drop it into casseroles, things like that.
Yes, you have obviously got to be very careful, but at the same time, being overcautious won't be a help either, will it?
No, I mean, that's I think part of the problem. We think that perhaps we've been a bit overcautious previously, and then that has caused perhaps more children to become allergic.
Do you think that is that what people are saying?
I think that there is some evidence that that by excluding a food, sometimes it does make a child more likely to become allergic.
This isn't a criticism of you, but it doesn't help that the advice just keeps changing. And I said we wanted to focus on eating well. I do think that's important. If your child, for whatever reason, allergic reaction or something else, can't eat a particular sort of food or chooses not to, how do you ensure they are getting all the right nutrients?
It depends what the food is. So obviously, if you're not eating eggs or you're not eating peanuts, that's not so much of a problem. If it's a big food group like cow's milk, you need to take extra care to make sure they get everything. So with cow's milk, it's calcium that you will be looking at. And also, taking cow's milk out from the diet excludes quite a lot of fat. You know, you wouldn't be having cheese, you wouldn't be having yogurt.
Yeah.
But it's perfectly possible to feed a child without those foods.
Is it? So what do you give them?
Well, you can use lots of different milks. If you've got a very small child, they would probably be on a prescribed formula. Older children can have oat milk or some of the other plant-based milks, soya milk, the nut milks. And they're all fortified with calcium to exactly the same level as they are in cow's milk.
And if you don't want to eat meat, or you, I suppose some people could be allergic to meat, couldn't they? Is that is the thing, is it? You don't look very sure. Potentially.
Potentially. Yeah. Yes, potentially.
OK, so pulses, lentils, but then you could be allergic to them too.
You could. I mean, we do see children that do have multiple allergies. And obviously, the more allergies you have, the more difficult it is to find foods that you can eat.
I just want to mention this email from Becky. My first child was allergic to cow dairy. I gave up dairy as the protein was passing through my breast milk, ended up doing loads of baking and making food from scratch. 4 years later and 100 attempts at the milk ladder, we have finally completed it, and he's okay with dairy in his diet. So that fascinates me. I mean, very briefly, Claire, why do some people then grow out of allergies?
A lot of people, yes, they do grow out of allergies. It's just they gradually build up the tolerance, which is what the milk ladder does. It gradually builds up your tolerance to the foods that you've previously been allergic to.
Our thanks to Claire Thornton-Wood, paediatric dietitian. Now, lots of emails on the subject of the right age, so-called, to have a baby. And obviously, there is no one. So actually, judging by your emails, there definitely isn't. Here's one listener who says, I'm a Hasidic woman and I was married at 18, pregnant at 19. I was told that contraception causes infertility and cancer by the older women I knew, and there was pressure to have children immediately. Early marriage and subsequent childbearing is the norm in my community. I think it's to control women and keep them in marriages that they might not otherwise submit to. That is a very particular life experience. And our thanks to the listener for contacting us on that. From C, I had my first children, twins at 34 and my third at 38. I was happy with the timing at the time. However, I now regularly appreciate that my mum was young, 23, when she had me, as she is fit and well enough to enjoy having grandchildren. Sadly, my dad, who was 37 when I was born, was never well enough to know my children for that long before he died at 76. For that reason, I wish I'd had them younger. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I must admit, I think about that. So I have my children at 35 and 38, nearly 39. And yes, that is a factor. I do wonder whether I'll be any use as a grandparent. Actually, I wonder whether I'll be any use whatever age the children are born, or hopefully born, she says, trying hard not to put pressure on her children, who won't be listening, so that's all right. This is from Hannah. I was 23 and I found it isolating, as none of my friends could imagine what it was like when I had a baby. I felt so young and unresourced compared to other mothers discussing extensions and mortgages. And I totally lost my identity, made up of friends, social life and travelling. However, our surprise baby changed the course of our lives so much, pushing us to create the life we wanted. I've just had my second at 27, and it was such a different experience being in a better place to have a child. I feel so supported by the community we've found now and really proud of the family life we've made for our daughters. At any age, it's hard, and the shift to motherhood isn't supported or celebrated enough. Hannah, thank you very much for that. From Jill, I had my first child when I was 21, second at 41. I loved being a mother both times, but did feel that my maturity and the change in parenting styles advocated, i.e. no smacking, etc., with the birth of my second child, meant I was a more skilled mother. I can only gauge this by the absolute success of my 24-year-old son in everything he does. I'm 65 now, says Jill. From Alison, I had my first child at 41, second at 44. My biggest regret is not having had them sooner. I'm not sure why I left it so late. I just never had the urge that friends had spoken of, and I was busy doing other things. But now I wish I could be a part of my children's life for longer than I'm likely to be, and I wish I'd had them at least a decade earlier. From Ruth, I had twins at 47, having tried for 8 years. 47 and twins. They are amazing, and not a moment of joy is missed. Obviously, at this age, it is physically more demanding, but my career is established, and I'm a wiser, more mature, settled person. I wish my pregnancies at 39 had survived, but of course, I feel very lucky to have my babies even at this age. I'm sure you do, and Ruth, congratulations to you for that, and thanks to everybody who took part today. Join Jenny for the programme and the podcast tomorrow. Her guests include Dame Glenys Stacey, Chief Inspector of Probation. She's just about to step down for that role, but she's got plenty to say to Jenny, and that'll be tomorrow.
Oi, you. While you're here, have a listen to this, would you?
Forest Fire.
An environmental thriller for BBC Sounds.
I'm so sorry.
Meet Pan.
Oh, I did.
She lives a few centuries from now, after a data crash that wiped out most records of life.
Shunk.
So when she finds an old recording of a rainforest, she has no idea what it is.
Forest 404. Nine-part thriller, nine-part talk, nine-part soundscape.
Starring Pearl Mackey, Tanya Moody and Pippa Hayward, with theme music by Bonobo.
Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Subscribe now.